All right. Hey, we're going to kick off the teaching in this series. You've got it made looking at Genesis right after we do our generosity stuff. So if this is, guys, you can come on down. You never know what to call you, people with baskets. Come on down. And if you came prepared to give, then this is your time to do that. A lot of us give online. You can do that through our Push Pay app that you can download in the iTunes store or whatever the other Android place is. And you can get that and give online, or you can give right now. We're getting ready to launch into studying this, of course, very ancient text that some of us have a lot of familiarity with, and some of us just maybe barely remember a few stories from it. There are parts of it that I suppose could be controversial. What we're going to do here tonight is something a little different. I'm just going to tell you the story as best I can of the book of Genesis. It's 50 chapters. I've done this before. Took me 95 minutes. You guys don't have plans, right? You're good? Charlie said I could do it in 30, and then he left town. So that's what we're going to give it a shot. And I think this is very important, actually, before you study anything, but any book of the Bible, is understand that these were stories that were, first of all, oral traditions before they were written down. People first heard these stories from someone else telling them. And that we can get lost in the weeds in all of life when we study things if we don't first come from the big perspective and say, what is this book as a whole trying to say, trying to tell us, before we kind of jump in and try to figure out what every single word means in context. Next week, I'll be back and looking at the first chapter of Genesis, so it'll be kind of the opposite. We'll spend a ton of time just looking at a few verses. But today, we're going to try to tell a whole story. You guys in? All right. Thank you. It's my mom. All right. Here we go. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. That's all I got memorized. I'm not going to quote 50 chapters, but that's how it starts. Almost poetic. Shrouded in mystery. Doesn't tell us where God comes from. Tells us that he took disorder. He took chaos. And he gave order to it. After he creates light, he creates the sun, the moon, the stars, mountains, rivers, vegetation. He creates fish, birds, aardvarks, zebras, house cats. He makes them all. And after everything God makes, he says the same thing in this first chapter. He says, "It is good. It's good. It's good." And then he makes man. You know what he says, ladies? "It's very good." That's what he says. I didn't write it. I just tell you what's in there. It says, the first man, he says, "Very good." And there's nothing so far in this text that hasn't been either good or very good. And then we hear the first thing that's not good. He says, "It's not good for man to be alone. I'll make someone for him." People have used that verse, by the way, to try to justify sexism throughout the years. To me, it means completely opposite. Like, this dude needs some help, some serious help. And God makes woman, and man and woman come together. God names the man Adam, which means man. Names are super important in this book. Eve is named Eve, which means mother of all who will live. It's a beautiful story. Go to the second chapter. God says you can eat from any tree in the garden. Just don't eat from the tree of the middle of the garden. If you eat from the tree in the middle of the garden, you'll die. The very next scene, there's the woman staring at the tree. First thing it tells us about ourselves, of course, is if you tell us not to do something, we might give it a shot. It's just in us. She's in the tree, and then along comes the talking snake. She doesn't know snakes are supposed to talk yet. Just the second chapter. Give her a break, right? And the snake says, hey, did God really say you shouldn't eat from any tree in the garden? I don't know why my snake was so casual, but hey, yo, Eve, hey, what's up? Did God really say that? And Eve says, no, God said we can eat from any tree in the garden. He says, just only from this one tree, this tree right here. And the snake says, you know, the reason he told you that is if you eat from this tree, you'll become like God. You'll become like him. He doesn't want that. He wants to be the only one. You'll know everything. So she looks at the fruit and it looks good to her. It looks like it'll be good food and she's interested and she wants to be like God. So she takes it and she takes a bite and she eats it. And then if this were a movie, we would pan out and we would see her bonehead husband standing there the whole time, not interacting with the snake, just letting the whole thing go down. At any moment, he could have said, wait a second, but he doesn't. He takes the fruit and he eats it. And immediately they realize something's not right. For the first time ever, they realize they're naked. And they're embarrassed by that for some reason. They go and they hide in the bushes. God comes strolling through the garden looking for Adam and Eve, and he calls them by name. And they're not good at anything yet because it's so early on. They're not good at hiding. God says, Adam, where are you? And he says, quote, I'm hiding in the bushes right over here. Why are you hiding, Adam? Because that woman that you made, she gave me the fruit and I ate it. God says, Eve. She says, well, that snake that you made, he told me it was okay. And here we have what becomes a curse for all of us that we must live under, right? That we are prone to that, to which we should not do, but we do it anyway, and there's punishment with it, lots of specific things, but ultimately the punishment is death. That we will die and we are kicked out of the paradise. God puts an angel with a flaming sword flashing back and forth so that they can't come back in the garden, and he kicks them out. But he does make clothes for them. He sends them on a journey that we continue today, a journey to get back, to find paradise, to not have to be God. Well, Adam and Eve are given a few commands. One of them is have sex and make babies, which they were cool with. They were down with that, and they started doing that. And they had two sons, Cain and Abel. And the story of Genesis really begins, in my mind, in terms of its major theme, with the Cain and Abel story. So these are brothers. They grow up, and they decide they want to worship God. This is the very formations of some sort of religious practice that's really vague and hard for us to get our head around. But one of the brothers had animals, and one of the brothers had a field. And Cain, who's the farmer, comes and kills his brother Abel because he was frustrated with the way their worship was going. There was something about the religious practice made him angry, which is also a precursor to a lot of stuff. And he kills him. By the fourth chapter, we're killing each other. And God sees us. And God comes to Cain and he says, where's your brother Abel? And Cain says, I don't know. Am I my brother's keeper? God doesn't answer that question. Am I my brother's keeper? Am I my brother's keeper? That's the question. That, in my opinion, is the question the entire book will try to answer. Time and time again, story after story, it will never say those words again. But you can look at every single story and see, oh, it's trying to answer that question. What do I have anything to do with do I really have some responsibility for my brother? Or is it just about me? Well, Cain is cursed. A lot of cursing going on early on. By the sixth chapter, it says this, every inclination of the thought of every person was only evil all the time. A lot of qualifiers there. Let me do it again. Every inclination of the thoughts of every person was only evil all the time. Things were not going well. it was this this great experiment was not working out. Save one family, one person, Noah, and his sons and their wives. So God decides he's going to destroy the entire earth with a flood, but he calls Noah to build an ark to start over. This is sort of a second creation story. It's a reboot. It's a restart. And God sends rain on the earth, and there's a flood. And Noah exits the ark a year after he enters it, and they begin again. And the first thing Noah does is he makes a vineyard. He plants grapes, and he stares at them until they grow. And then he harvests them, and he stares at it until it makes wine. This is what you do after a year-long boat trip. And then he gets drunk off his gourd. They don't teach you that in Sunday school. Super important part of the Noah story. Sorry, kids. Don't do that. Noah was not good when he did that. So, but it tells us something. The reboot, we're sort of prone to just go sideways. And then there's an even weirder story where one of Noah's sons comes into his father's tent when his father's naked and does something questionable, and it creates this whole weird dynamic in the family, so that Noah comes out right after the reboot and he says he curses one of his sons. He has three. And he basically says this one son, he gives him a curse, and he says, I hope bad things happen to you, in essence. And the two sons, his favorites, he says, you guys are good. I hope good things happen to you. Brothers, divided. Am I my brother's keeper? The heart of the story of Genesis begins now in chapter 12. This is the story of Abram. This is a foundational story, not just for our faith, but for all the, all the great monotheistic faiths. Father Abraham. Abram, by the way, means father. And he's married to Sarai. And Sarai's name means princess. There's a great irony in their names. Father Abraham, Abram, he'll get his name changed to Abraham later. Abram is 75 years old, which seems younger every year to me. And Sarai is just a little younger. And they have no kids, which is everything in this culture. Even more important than wealth is kids, someone to pass things on to, someone to work for you. Someone in this sort of environment, even to be a household army, to fight for you if you need it, especially sons. And they have nothing. Can you imagine going to the market and your name's Dad? Your name is Dad. How'd you get that name? My dad gave it to me. Thought I was going to have a lot of kids. Or princess. Your name is Princess and you have no people, no nation. Well, Abram wasn't worshiping Yahweh, but a voice comes to him and says, Abram, Abram, go to the land I will show you, and I will make you a great nation. The voice says, go out and look at the stars in the sky. This was before light pollution. And he says, try to count them. He can't count them. He says, go to the seashore and try to count the sand on the seashore. He can't. It's too many. The voice says, I will make your descendants from your children more numerous than the sand of the seashore, more numerous than the stars in the sky, and the entire world will be blessed by your children. And the voice just says, leave. Leave where you're from and go that way. And Abram is known as the father of faith because he said, okay. He just left. He started walking. In faith, he left. That this voice was actually God and not just in his head, and that he was going to become a great nation. Well, he got older and older. In his 80s, the voice comes back and says, oh, by the way, I'm still going to do that. And then Abram says, how is this going to happen? I'm old, and more importantly, my wife, she's old too. Like we can't have babies. But the voice promises it. Well, Abram takes matters into his own hands, And he goes and he asks his wife, Sarai, hey, can I sleep with your servant? And she says, sure. This is not a good book, by the way, for marriage. I do not recommend it at all to discover the hidden truths of monogamy. Sarah says, yeah, go ahead. So he sleeps with her. Her name's Hagar. I assume she was a lovely lady. It's a rough name. Her name's Hagar. And she conceives and she gives birth to Ishmael. And so Abram does what so many people try to do when God says something's going to happen. He goes and he makes it happen. And then God says, basically, that's not what I meant. I meant you're going to have a son with Sarai. As a matter of fact, I'm going to change your names. You're going to be Abraham now, not Abram. She's going to be Sarah, not Sarai. Abraham means the father of many kids. Now that's his name with no kids. And Sarah means queen mother. That's just cruel. And time goes on. An angel comes one day to tell Abraham, it's about time. It's really almost about time. 99 years old. Sarah's listening in the tent and hears the angel say that they're going to have a baby and she laughs. The angel says, why'd you laugh? She says, I didn't laugh. She did. She was a liar. And then wouldn't you know it, the next month, Sarah comes into Abraham's tent. Abraham! I'm late! You're always late to everything. No, no. I don't know if that's how it went down. The old woman is impregnated, which if you could speed read the entire Bible, by the way, happens a lot. And she starts to make a baby in her womb in her 90s. And you know what people do when they look at her? They laugh. It's ridiculous. It's silly. And then she has a baby, the promised baby. You know what they name him? Laughter. Isaac means laughter. This is it. Abraham and Sarah love Isaac more than Ishmael, the baby that they did a roundabout with the promise to try to make happen. From the moment Isaac is born, he's struggling with his brother. They will become two nations that will fight one another. Am I my brother's keeper? You know, it's looking like no. No. We're all got to kind of be in it for ourselves, you know. Isaac grows up. Laughter grows up. Gets married to a hot shepherdess. For whatever reason, girl shepherds in the Bible are always described as super beautiful and alluring. And Isaac marries one named Rebecca. And they have a super dysfunctional relationship that they will pass on to their children for generations to come. And she conceives, Rebecca does. So now Abraham, his line, his family line, is going to bump up from just Isaac, his one son, to three, because she's going to have twins. And it's starting to happen. This family is starting to grow very slowly. And these twin babies are in her womb. It says that they were wrestling in the womb with one another. And as they were born, the first one to come out, they named Esau because he was red and hairy. And Esau means red and hairy. And the second one to come out came out grabbing Esau's heel. And they named him Jacob. Any Jacobs here? It means smooth or slick because he was not hairy. And it also, just like in the connotation we have today, means the same thing, like a slick, like almost like a con man. Like, you know, he's slick. And here, we can't get any more clear than this. Are these brothers going to fight? Yeah, they already are, in the womb. And Jacob does everything he can to steal what is rightfully Esau's through his whole life. Esau is painted as a very good son to Isaac and a little bit of kind of a bonehead, dumb guy. He loves to hunt and do manly things and not the smartest guy in the world. Jacob likes to hang out with his mom and he cooks and cleans and stuff like that. One day, Esau goes out hunting, and he doesn't find anything, so he comes back starving. And Jacob, I was picturing wearing an apron with a wooden spoon, stirring soup. Esau comes in. He's like, "I'm starving. I haven't eaten for a day." And Jacob's like, "I'm making soup." And Esau's like, "Oh, give it to me." And Jacob says, "You have to give me something first." "What?" "Everything you own forever." "Well, fine. I am hungry." That's basically how that story goes down. And so Jacob steals Esau's birthright, steals his inheritance, steals. He in essence becomes the firstborn son. But he still needs his father's blessing, which is very important all through the book of Genesis and in the ancient world, and we don't get it. It's so hard for us to get, excuse me, but they deeply believed that what a father would say over a son or daughter would happen. And if they blessed their son or daughter, that they would receive blessings in the future. So it was just as important as the physical stuff to get the spiritual blessing that you will be the one to carry on the family. Isaac, the father, has gone blind. And Rebekah loves Jacob more than Esau, because the brothers don't get along. Isaac loves Esau more than Jacob. And Rebekah, the mother, comes to her son, Jacob, the slick one, the con artist. And he learns how to be a con artist from his sweet mother. And what she says to him is, "Hey, listen, your father's ready. He's about to die probably. He needs to give his blessing to Esau. But I want you to steal the blessing." And Jacob says, "Oh, nice. Good idea." And she says, "This is how it's going to happen since your dad is blind. He's going to go out hunting to get some dinner for your dad. And I'm going to have you go back in and pretend to be him." And he's like, "But mother, I sound nothing like Esau." And she says, "Don't worry, just grunt a lot. And we're going to put sheepskin on your arms so you're hairy. And we're going to like roll you around with the animals so you smell bad like your brother. And then we're going to trick your dad into giving you the blessing." Another brilliant plan that they pull off pretty well. Esau goes to find some wild game for his dad. A couple hours later, Jacob comes in, smelling like Esau. And he gives him the blessing. And he says, "You know, the smell is the smell of my son Esau, but the voice is more like the voice of Jacob." Yeah. But he gives him the blessing anyway. Then Esau comes back, and he's spitting mad. There's about to be another brother murder. So Jacob, at the urging of his mother, runs away. He runs to his uncle Laban's house, who's basically Billy Dee Williams. It's the best way to think about it if you know Star Wars. It's Lando, the old Lando, before the new movie. he goes off and... his uncle Laban is as big a con artist as any of them. Seems to be in the blood in this family to trick people. So he's going to take his nephew and he's going to trick him. Because when Jacob shows up on the run from his brother Esau, he sees a smoking hot shepherdess named Rachel. And he thinks, I want to marry her. Now they're cousins because it's Genesis. And it's fine. Don't ask those kind of questions. Jacob sees Rachel, falls in love at first sight. Rachel means like little lamb. That's what Rachel means. She's got a sister named Leah. Leah's a beautiful name. It means cow eyes, just so you know. I'm sorry. I hate that because Leah's a very popular name. I can't change that. At least at the time this was written, they think maybe she was called that because she had eyesight problem or something. And Laban says, "Jacob, if you want to marry Rachel, my daughter, I know you're smitten with her. Just work for me 7 years. If you work for me 7 years, I'll give her to you as your wife." And because of his great love for her, he does. He works 7 years for the girl. And then evidently at night, with no lights on, they get married. They go to the tent to consummate. Jacob wakes up the next morning, rolls over, and it's cow eyes. It's not the little lamb. And he freaks out. And he runs to his uncle Laban and he says, "You promised me the pretty one." And he says, Laban says, "Hey, it's not our custom, man. You know, we always give the older daughter in marriage, but don't worry, you can have them both. Take Rachel too for another 7 years. Tell you what, this time I'll prepay. You can have her now, but you got to promise to work 7 more years. So the day after he married Leah, he marries her sister. And am I my sister's keeper becomes one of the questions here too. This becomes one of the most dysfunctional families you could ever imagine. They get in a competition over who can have the most babies. Leah is great at making babies. She has like 4 in a row. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah. Rachel can't have babies. So Rachel says, "Hey, I got an idea. Just thought of it. Sleep with my servant. And then those babies can count for me." Deep in her subconscious, she learned this from her like grandparents, right? And Jacob says, "Yeah, good idea." So he does that. Then Leah says, "That's not fair. If you sleep with her servant, you got to sleep with my servant too." And Jacob says, "All right." And what will become the 12 tribes of Israel come from 2 fighting sisters telling their husbands to sleep with women that aren't his wife to make babies for them. And it is a mess. Jacob loves his kids. But Rachel, Jacob now has 10 boys and a daughter through the other 3 women, but Rachel still hasn't had a baby. And then finally, God opens her womb, and she gives birth. And she gives birth to a boy named Joseph. And Joseph means terribly good looking. Joseph means, may God add, because she says this. She gets her first baby finally, and she names him, "Give me another baby." That's what it means. May God give me more. May God add. But Jacob, the father, loves Joseph way more, obviously more, than his 10 brothers, because he really only loves Rachel. She's sort of the real wife. These other women are just around to make babies, to build an army, to build a people. So he decides that Joseph is his best son, his favorite son. And Joseph grows up in a culture being told every day, "You're the chosen one. You're the best one. You're the one who's going to lead this family someday." If it were the 80s, he would have given him a starter jacket. he gives him some Air Jordans or something. He gives him a coat of many colors. He dresses him nicer than his brothers because he loves him more than his brothers. Because you can't have a story in this book without there being tension between brothers and sisters. Well, Joseph is born with a special ability. He has this sort of mystical connection with God, and he is able to kind of, in some ways, almost foretell and see the future. He gets dreams, and his dreams mean something, and he's able to interpret them. He's able to interpret other people's dreams. So here he is, this teenage savant that everyone sort of hates because of how much his father loves him and dotes over him. And he also has this sort of special gift that almost justifies the fact that everyone loves him, or that his father loves him more. So Joseph starts having these dreams when he's 17. And he would call his family over. He'd say, "Mom, Dad, brothers, come here." I imagine he talks like that. "I had a dream. In my dream, see if you can help me figure out what it means. I was a star, like in the sky, and there were 11 stars, like I have 11 brothers, and the sun and the moon in the sky, and they all started bowing down to me, like I was really special or something. What do you guys think that could mean?" Then the next night, he has another dream. I had another dream. I was in a field with my 11 brothers, and we all had sheaves of grain in front of us. And then the sheaves of grain started walking around because it's a dream. You know, anything can happen. And your sheaves of grain, all my brothers, you came over to mine and it started bowing down to me. What in the world do you think that could mean? His brothers hated him. Hated him. Plus, he didn't have to work. He would send the other 10 brothers that, by the way, Rachel had a second son named Benjamin, which means son of my right hand. She dies in childbirth. So Benjamin is Joseph's full brother, little brother. He doesn't have to work either. But the 10 older ones, they're out, they're shepherds. They're out watching sheep. They're a couple days away. So one day, Jacob, the father, he sends Joseph out to check on his brothers to see if they're okay. They see him coming from afar and they say, oh, here comes that dreamer. They're like, you know what we should do?
What?
Kill him. And they're all like, hmm, yeah, that's a great idea. Let's kill our brother because he's the worst. And then Reuben, the firstborn, the leader, he steps up. He says, guys, come on, we're better than that. Let's not kill him. Let's sell him as a slave. Make some money, but at least keep him alive. And then we'll strip him of his pretty jacket and we'll kill an animal and we'll put a bunch of animal blood on it. We'll take it back to dad and we'll say, we found this jacket. This looks like your son Joseph's jacket. He must have gotten eaten by a wild animal. We're really sorry, dad. I think he's dead. But really, we wouldn't have killed him, which is kind of bad anyway, and we'll make a few bucks. So that's what they do. They sell him. They throw him in a pit, an empty cistern. And what's interesting about Joseph is all these characters are flawed, right? And Joseph is a super brat. But I like to think, like, as Joseph is falling down into that empty cistern to hit the ground, he kind of grows up in the 1 second of that fall. And when he hits the ground, it's like it knocks some sense into him. And he realizes he's been a brat and this is not good. And really, from this point forward, Joseph becomes sort of a model citizen to kind of live your life after. But he goes on a crazy journey. His brothers pull him out of the pit. They take his robe. They do the whole deal with their father. Breaks his father's heart. He mourns every day of his life. And they sell Joseph to a band of Ishmaelite merchants. Who I like to imagine, if you've seen Gladiator, where they have the kind of the carts going through and the slaves and the kind of the merchants that will go through the desert going from town to town selling animals and slaves and goods. Well, they sell him and he ends up in Egypt. He's purchased by a man named Potiphar, who's a general in the Egyptian army. Egypt is the superpower of the day. It's running the whole region. It's Pharaoh is the most powerful person in the world, the ruler of Egypt. And this man works directly for Pharaoh. A pattern begins in Joseph's life that is really interesting. Anytime Joseph gets a new job, he's put in charge, no matter what the job is. So here he's a slave, and Potiphar looks at Joseph, and he says, here's the keys to my house. I'm leaving. I'm going to go to war for a couple years. You're in charge of everything. I mean everything. You run my household. You make it sing. You make it work. You take care of my wife. You take care of my kids. And Joseph, this Hebrew slave, at 18 years old, is in charge of the general's whole estate. And then turns into The Graduate, that movie. Remember that movie? So as soon as Potiphar leaves, Potiphar's wife, who her name, by the way, is Potiphar's wife. We don't know her name. So Potiphar's wife sees Joseph, and she comes up to him, and she says, come to bed with me. And he says, no, I'm not doing that. Well, the next day he goes to work, and she comes up to him, and she says, hey, you know, come to bed with me. And he says, no, I won't do that. That's sinning against God, and it's sinning against Potiphar, and I'm not going to do it. Because he's a pretty good guy. She comes to him a third day. You're going to have sex with me, she says. He says, I'm not. She grabs him by his coat. There's also a weird theme of Joseph's coats through this story. She grabs him by his coat and tries to sort of rape him. And he wriggles out of the jacket and runs away, runs out of the house. She comes running after him, holding his jacket up, saying, my slave tried to rape me, my slave tried to rape me. And he's immediately arrested and thrown into dungeon. When he hits the floor of the dungeon master looks at him and says, hey, here's the keys to the dungeon. You're in charge. I want you just don't leave. You stay here, and you take care of everybody else. I'm going on vacation, so he leaves. So Joseph now runs the dungeon in Egypt as a prisoner, as a convicted rapist for a crime he did not commit. Not just a crime he didn't commit, but he was doing the right thing, and he got accused of doing the worst thing ever, and now he's stuck here with people he doesn't know, with a language he has to learn to speak. Like, it's not good. And then several years in, he hears two of the prisoners talking to each other about weird dreams they had. And he says, I'm kind of good at dreams. Let me hear your dreams. This is the chief cupbearer and the chief baker. They held high positions in Pharaoh's court, and they had done something to upset the Pharaoh. So Pharaoh threw them into the dungeon, and now they're having these weird dreams. So the chief cupbearer, he goes first. And a cupbearer is a very important position in the ancient world. Basically, all the job description is drink the king's wine and see if you die. And if you don't, give the wine to the king. But because that was your job description, they became very trusted allies of kings, of trusted advisors. So he did something to upset the king. He said, okay, I don't know if this dream means anything. Here's my dream. It's kind of weird. It's a dream. So he says, okay, in my dream, I was the cupbearer again, right? And I had my cup, and there were these three clusters of grapes. And I squeezed the grapes, and it made wine, and I put it in my cup, and I went to give it to Pharaoh, and he seemed pretty pleased about it. And Joseph says, that's easy. I'm good at this. I promise. Here's what your dream means. In the three cups, or the three groups of grapes, are 3 days. In 3 days, Pharaoh will lift you up and give you your job back. And he's excited. And the chief baker hears this. And he gets excited. He says, my dream's kind of similar. Tell me what it means. He said, okay. In my dream, I had three baskets of bread on my head. And these birds kept eating it. That's about it. What do you think it means? He just says, that's easy. The three baskets are 3 days. In 3 days, Pharaoh will lift you up and cut your head off. And in 3 days, that's what happened. As they were leaving out of prison, Joseph stops and says nothing to the baker, because who cares about that guy. He goes to the cupbearer. He's like, listen, I don't deserve to be here. You know I'm a good guy. I didn't do this. Please, when you get your job back in an hour, tell Pharaoh about me. See if you can do something to get me out of here. And the guy says, trust me, if that dream comes true, I will never forget you. He goes up, he gets his job back, the other guy gets beheaded, and he forgets about Joseph for 2 years. And then one day, the Pharaoh comes to the cupbearer, and he says, I've had some weird dreams. Do you know anyone? And he's like, oh, yes, totally forgot. There's a guy who did nothing wrong who's in the dungeon, by the way. His name is Joseph, and you should call him up because he's super good at this. And so they call for Joseph. He takes a quick bath, he shaves, and he comes in front of Pharaoh. This is where the whole story has been leading, this whole story. Now we have a descendant of Abraham, this promised nation, standing in front of the most powerful man in the ancient world. This man could do anything good or bad for Joseph in any second. And the Pharaoh says, I hear you can interpret dreams. And Joseph says, I'm pretty good at it. And Pharaoh says, well, I had two dreams. He said, in my first dream, I saw the Nile River, which of course represents all of Egypt. And he said, there were these cows that came out of the river. It's weird. It was a dream. Seven beautiful cows, just amazing cows. I can't explain how beautiful, you know, I have to stop and Pharaoh's way into the cows, right? And he said, they come out of the river and they're just standing there. And then these seven scrawny zombie cows crawl out of the river and they eat the seven healthy cows. And then I woke up. It was terrifying. I hate zombie cows. But then I fell back to sleep, and I had another dream where there were these seven beautiful heads of grain. Just marvelous. The best grain. Okay, Pharaoh, we get it. They're beautiful, right? And he said, but then these seven gnarly, evil heads of grain came and started eating them. He's like, what's it mean? Joseph says, this is actually pretty easy. The dreams mean exactly the same thing. You were given them twice because God is certain he's going to do this. You can't change his mind. For the seven cows and the seven heads of grain, they both equal 7 years. For the next 7 years, you will have abundance like Egypt has never known. Anything you try to do agriculturally is going to work, and you're going to make a ton of money. That's what the cows and the good heads of grains are. But after that will come 7 years of famine. Any seed you plant in the ground won't grow. It's going to be terrible. 7 years of plenty, followed by 7 years of famine. And Pharaoh says, what should I do? And Joseph says, I mean, if I were you, I would find your most trusted advisor, the person, your all-star, and I would put him in charge for the next 7 years to collect grain. Collect as much grain as you can. Build new cities that are just there to store all this grain you're going to get. And then, when the second 7 years comes, you'll be able to feed your people. Not only your people, but nations will come from all over the world to buy that grain from you, and you will just become richer and richer and richer. And Pharaoh says, you're in charge. And I'm going on vacation. He makes Joseph, this slave, the second most powerful person in the most powerful country in the world, like that. And he does. He goes off and fights a war. Joseph's in charge of Egypt. Still a relatively young man. But like a Bangles song, anyone ahead of me? He starts to walk like an Egyptian, talk like an Egyptian. Little Gen X humor for you. And it happens. 7 years of plenty, store up all the grain. The famine hits. The famine's terrible. People are dying everywhere except Egypt. The Egyptian people are happy. People start coming to Egypt. Joseph is the one managing the sale of all the grain. People come up to them. They're giving him their life savings for food. There's a line of people from all these surrounding nations. And wouldn't you know it, one day, Joseph's sitting on a throne. He appears to be the king of Egypt to all these people. And these 10 men come up, and he immediately knows it's his brothers, the ones who sold him, the ones who are directly responsible for him being convicted as a rapist, for being in that dungeon. They don't recognize him because he's all dressed up like an Egyptian, and they would have no construct, no idea that it could be him. They come to him and they say, my Lord, we are 10 of 12 brothers. The youngest is with our father, and one of our brothers was eaten by an animal. We come to you now begging, please, our family's dying. Please sell us grain. And Joseph holds back tears, sells them grain. And he says, but you need to bring that younger one back to prove your story, or I'll hunt you down. So they go back and they tell their father, Jacob, who's very old, that this important king wants to see Benjamin, Joseph's little brother. And Jacob won't let him. He's like, I lost Joseph. I'm not going to lose Benjamin too. He's the only one I really love. And then they run out of food. So they have to take Benjamin and go back. And they stand in line again. Joseph sees them and he turns to one of the servants. He says, do you see those 11? Take them to my quarters and fix a nice meal for them. So they go and they grab them. They put them in a room. And they think they're in trouble. But then this feast comes out. And just in a time of famine, just tons of food. Steaks. Creme brulee. I don't know what they had. Lots of good stuff. Except Benjamin would always get seven times. He'd get seven steaks. He got seven scoops of ice cream. And the brothers are like, what in the world's going on? And then finally Joseph loses it. He breaks down, starts crying. They still don't know what's happening. And he says, I'm your brother. It's me. And they go, uh-oh. That's not really good news. That's a very conflicted feeling we're going through right now. And it can't be good. And they look, they're in an enclosed room. And Joseph says, is my father alive? And I say, yeah. And he says, I want you to come here. I want you to come live here in Egypt. Go get my father and bring him back. And so the brothers do. And they come back with this old man, Jacob, who also has, by the way, calmed down. And God changed his name. He's not Slickster anymore. Changed his name from Jacob to Israel. Israel means he wrestles with God, yet he overcomes. And there's this beautiful, heart-wrenching moment where the favorite son sees his father for the first time in decades, and they embrace. Thought he was dead. He's alive. And the brothers are sort of happy and sort of worried. And eventually Jacob dies in Egypt. And the brothers come and they tell Joseph a lie. They say, "You weren't there for our father's dying words, but his dying words were that he wanted you to know that you have to forgive us for what we did." And Joseph is heartbroken because he says, "How could my father think I wouldn't?" And then he says this. This is the end of the book. What you intended for evil, God used for good, for the saving of all of our lives. Besides, he says, "You're my brothers. How could I not keep you safe?" That's the answer. Am I my brother's keeper? Yep. Am I my sister's keeper? Yes. Am I my neighbor's keeper? Am I to keep even people I don't know safe? There's lots of weird stories in this book. There's lots of things to spend a lot of time trying to figure out and study. But I'm convinced there is one theme you can't get around, and this is it. That when God looks at us, as dysfunctional as we are, God sees one family. Many, many years later, the Apostle Paul would write that in Christ, there is no such thing as slave or free or male or female or Jew or Gentile. Or Republican or Democrat, or black or white or brown, old or young. We're one. We're one family. We're here to take care of each other, not to fight, not to kill each other. That's the worst part of us. The best part of us, the part that is like God, is the one that can look into the eyes of those who have even hurt us the most and say, "You intended it for evil. God used it for good. Besides, you're my brother. How could I not keep you? How could I not be your keeper?" The band's going to come out. They're going to do one more song. I would just encourage you to use this time. I guess you can sing along if you know it, but just kind of think about the words of this song and see if it might apply to the person in your life that's hard for you to keep. See how it might apply when you think about what it means for us not to be a whole bunch of people, but to be one family. All right. Let's pray, and then we'll listen to the song. God, we are so broken and selfish and irritable, and yet we have such amazing capacity for love that comes from you. Help us to walk out of this room today determined to keep one another safe. Amen.